Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're going to open talking about one of your most precious privileges as an American and a Connecticut resident, your right to vote. We're going to ring up the president of ROVAC, the Registrars of Voters Association of Connecticut, to talk about the most important updates and things you need to know to easily and successfully cast your ballots if you plan to participate either in person or by absentee ballot in the upcoming August 11th primaries. Then we're going to head to the gardens of Common Ground High School, a charter school in New Haven and the oldest environmental charter school in the United States, to learn how its staff is preparing students for college success and a lifetime of environmental leadership. And we'll close with the latest in our Counting on 2020 census segments as we head into Census Push Week to determine who can push a greater self-response rate between July 27th and August 2nd. We're going to find out from a regional census director how Push Week aims to increase 2020 census self-response rates via local activities, parades, social messaging campaigns, and more. So stay tuned. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Southwest Cafe is proud to present the 14th annual Southwest Cafe Margarita Virtual 5K to benefit Ability Beyond. Although the race will be held virtually due to safety issues with gathering in large crowds, runners will still get a margarita. Participants can run a 5K anytime between July 31st at midnight and August 2nd at 11:59 p.m. People can run anywhere that's safe, including a treadmill. Organizers discourage running the traditional in-person course, as there'll be no traffic control or police. So all you need to do is pay your registration cost of $20. You'll receive a tech t-shirt and race bib that becomes your coupon for a margarita while helping benefit Ability Beyond, which is providing a wide range of services for over 3,000 people with a disability that inhibits their activities of daily living. You can learn more about the organization and the benefit at abilitybeyond.org. Well, as we said in the show's introduction this morning, I'm really excited to be able to talk about voting and voting rights. And I've got the right person on the line to do it. From over in South Windsor, Sue Larson is joining us. She's the president of ROVAC, the Registrars of Voters Association of Connecticut. Right, Sue?
That is correct.
So, according to your mission statement, you've got really kind of a three-pronged mission, and that's providing and managing free, impartial, and democratic elections, in and of itself a huge responsibility, but also the it's establishing and administering voter registration enrollment procedures and maintaining and managing accurate voter registration records. I don't know if you could have wished for a time like we are in right now, but the convergence of the coronavirus pandemic and this situation that Connecticut and many other states are dealing with now, and trying to make the polls and polling procedures as safe as possible, and this situation we have going on in Connecticut with the fight to try to make mail-in and absentee voting kind of a standard for people to utilize to try to eliminate or diminish the transmission of the coronavirus is all putting a lot of weight and responsibility on your teams throughout the 669 communities here in Connecticut, isn't it?
Oh, it's been a very trying time for all of us, especially, you know, the what we call the implementation team that was assigned back in March to start working on exactly how are we going to accomplish this. So between the Secretary of the State's office, the Town Clerks Association, and ROVAC, we've been working hard to try and make sure that every voter has an opportunity to vote, whether it be by absentee ballot or by the ability to go to the the polls. So while the town clerks take most of the responsibility on the absentee ballot process, the registrars have been working on how do we make the polls safe, how many poll workers we will be able to get for the primary, and also starting to think about the presidential, and putting together all of our the layout of the polling places in order to maintain social distancing, make sure our poll workers are safe with all the proper PPE that we've been ordering. It's been very, very trying on both the town clerks and the registrars to put this together. But, you know, I have to say I've been very proud of all the registrars that have come up with a lot of unique ideas in all the different polling places on how to do this.
Well, folks in the towns and cities in Connecticut also should be really proud of the registrars, although they often go unnoticed and unsung until something goes wrong. And they shouldn't, because I know in my experience, at least, so many work so hard to not only get their job done, but to do it with no appearance of partisan politics, and yet kind of politics has entered into this. And I want to speak to one of the main points that critics seem to be making in regards to this massive mailing of applications for absentee ballots for the primaries, and how you know, so many of them are not necessarily reaching their intended target. Can you speak to the upside of trying to connect every single registered Republican and Democrat in Connecticut to the address on these applications, and how that could ultimately serve a positive purpose for the registrars across Connecticut?
Well, let me go back a little bit and say that, you know, every year we do a canvas of our voters. And when we do this canvas, it's based on, we match up our voter list to the NCOA, which is basically the postal system. And we try and clean up our voter rolls based on this canvas, and also what we call the ERIC report, which is a consortium of states that compare our voter list together, so that if, for example, John Smith moved out of Connecticut and he registered in, let's say, Colorado, just out of the blue. And because we don't have a communication between the two states on an automatic basis, that once a year gives us that opportunity to double check to make sure that John Smith is now registered in Colorado and he can come off our list. So we try as best we can to clean the list as best, you know, within the guidelines that we have. Mm-hmm. But so what's happening now is by sending out all of these absentee ballot applications, not ballots, we are catching the people that have recently moved since we did the canvas. So this is a good thing. It also allows us to catch up with college students. A lot of them are still home, and they may not be coming back to the college campuses if there's going to be no, if they're going virtual or whatever. So there's that aspect of it too. So between being able to capture the people who have moved out of state, and trying to work with the colleges and figuring out what's happening with are they coming back, or is it going to be virtual, it has led to a lot of good aspects of doing this as a trial run.
Yeah, and this is so important with all the younger people that are flooding onto the voting rolls, or at least expressing an interest in getting involved, if not in the primaries in November, you know, that this may add a measure of responsibility to registrars and other voting officials that they may not have seen since, you know, in a decade or two.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we also try, you know, to figure out, when we do this canvas, we do send out letters to people asking them, do they still live there if they haven't voted in 6 years, 8 years, whatever, just to see, because a lot of times people just forget to tell the registrars, I've moved from South Windsor to Berlin, and, you know, we don't know about it, and they, if it's not an election that they're interested in, for whatever reason, they don't register until they need to, we try and catch up and do as accurate a canvas as we possibly can,
oh, sure.
So that people are reminded. Okay, I forgot to register to vote in my new town, and this is great. Thanks for the reminder.
Right. Well, we're about a little over halfway through our chat with you. We just want to let folks know that may have joined us late that we're chatting with Sue Larson. She's not only the registrar of voters in South Windsor, but also the president of ROVAC, the Registrars of Voters Association of Connecticut. And, you know, there have been many changes to our everyday life because of the COVID-19 pandemic, but one of the most important is this meaningful act of citizenship that we are so honored and so often take for granted here in our own country and state, and that is our privilege to vote. And as we probably all know or should know, back in April, Governor Ned Lamont made a decision to postpone Connecticut's presidential primary to align with one that was already scheduled on August 11th for the state. So, Sue, this program is going to broadcast on Sunday, the 26th of August, and people will probably be tuning into the podcast over a few days following that or into the next week. So what are the most important deadlines that Republicans and Democrats need to know to be able to vote either by absentee or in person on August 11th? Here, as we talk on August 26th, are there any deadlines that have passed that would preclude people from being able to vote?
At this point, the 90-day requirement to switch major political parties is already passed. However, if you are registered unaffiliated, you have until Monday the 10th by noon to select either Democrat or Republican, because, of course, those are the only two that are having primaries.
Yep.
So they have until, like I said, Monday, August 10th at noontime, and they can go to their registrar or voter's office if they need to go in person, because the deadline for online or mail-in is 5 days prior to to August 11th. So I believe that's going to be about, about the 5th of August.
Okay.
So to make sure that if they need to change their unaffiliated status, that after 5th they have to go to and do it in person at the registrar's office.
Okay.
And the thing that I really want to point out is a lot of town halls are still closed to the public. So if they are going to have to do it in person, call their registrars and make an appointment with them to get that to get it changed, rather than just go to the town hall and just assume that that someone's there that's going to be able to take their new registration card.
And do it
so,
quick.
Right, exactly.
Sooner the better. Good. Folks, we're going to be just touching on a couple of the points inherent in a brand new ROVAC guide that was published just a few days ago, and that is their 2020 primary update called Voting During a Pandemic. You can access this a very informative document by going to ROVAC.org, that's ROVAC.org, to download it and check it. It's got a lot of interesting information as well as all the deadline and timing information that you'll need to know. But with the August 11th primary approaching rapidly, time is of the essence. Sue, before we let you go, we've got a couple more minutes. In looking across this document and talking with other registrars across Connecticut, what are a couple of the most prolific questions that are being asked, or, you know, which, what are some of the questions that are being asked and answered most frequently that folks seem to need to get oriented about?
Well, I think the question, the one that I've heard the most is, if do I have to fill out the ballot right away? Because if a person did the absentee ballot application, do I have to fill out the ballot right away? What do I, what if I want to go to the polls? Well, if you want to go to the polls, and then basically hold off on doing the sending in the absentee ballot. Hold off because you have until the day before or even the day of to put the absentee ballot that you received into one of the ballot boxes that are located outside of the outside of every town hall. Mm-hmm. Most towns have one. Some of the larger cities and larger towns have two. So if you are holding off right now saying, wow, everything looks good, so maybe I will go to the polls, and then all of a sudden a couple of days before the primary, a spike happens and you're fearful of going to the polls.
Yeah, you don't feel good.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Then you have that option to be able to still do the absentee ballot. If you've received it. So we've been telling people, you know, you have the option. Hold off, see how things go. Just make sure we have that absentee ballot by 8 p.m. on Tuesday in order for it to count. So those big mailbox-looking vote boxes are available at every single town, and they're there for people that are fearful of going to the polls or fearful of even going into the town hall. So the town clerks are checking those boxes every day. They've got the keys to get the boxes on the ballots out of there, so they're not left in the boxes for long periods of time. So voters have two options. The polling locations will be open. Call your town hall to find out if for some reason they had to be moved for social distancing purposes, mm-hmm. because we've got the double primary. But the polls will be open in all the towns.
Very good. Our guest for this first segment today is Sue Larson. She is not only a Registrar of Voters in South Windsor, but the president of the Registrars of Voters Association of Connecticut, ROVAC. If you'd like to view their or download ROVAC's 2020 primary update, Voting During a Pandemic, that has really all the information that you'd need to know about being involved or getting to a place where you can vote in the August 11th primary, just download it. It's right on their homepage when you go to their website, rovac.org. That's rovac.org. And Sue, probably lots more to talk about as we turn our attention after August 11th toward November. So I look forward to maybe talking with you or a designee again from ROVAC as we move toward the presidential election. So for now, thank you so much for being on the program. So in the second interview since this whole COVID-19 thing started happening in a big way here in Connecticut, I have broke free from the phone and happily am out on the farm right here in the city. Very pleased to be here at Common Ground High School with their farm director, Deborah Gregg. Who I learned about through an outreach message by a United Way through the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven. So by a circuitous route, we are here at the Common Ground High School. And if you're not familiar with it, this is a charter school right here in downtown New Haven that aims to prepare students for college success and environmental leadership. It was founded in 1997 in the first round of charter schools created in Connecticut, but most importantly, it's the oldest environmental charter school in the United States. So not just a historical educational environment, but historic also because it's the nation's longest running environmental charter school, which is creating this next generation of successful college students and powerful environmental leaders. Talking with Deborah before we turned on the microphone, we learned that this is a high school, but they expose young people much younger than high school through a community program, which we'll be talking about. But Deborah, first, let's just kind of clue people in on how this meeting happened. It really was in part because of COVID-19 and the needs of your own students' families. Let's talk about that and how United Way kind of got worked into the equation. And then you guys got a grant.
Yeah, sure. So the Common Ground Farm usually grows food for our students in a number of different ways. We usually provide food to the cafeteria, to teachers for different lessons, and to our students through a small farm share, where we usually serve about 25 students out of our 225 student population. So when COVID-19 happened and the school closed, we recognized that we had to pivot what we were doing. We almost immediately got feedback from families that we were reaching out to that they were facing all sorts of challenges like loss of employment, and also students didn't have access to the free lunch every day. So they were expressing a lot of food insecurity in their home life. So we started with just sort of inventorying what we had on the farm and sending boxes to about 30 families, and very quickly realized that there was much more demand for food than we had capacity for on the farm in March, when we have lettuce and eggs and maybe some spinach, yeah, but not much else going on. So we were looking for funding and support to be able to purchase food in for our families, and we sort of came upon this United Way funding that was looking at emergency responses to COVID. Yep. And we had a slightly different goal than some of the other emergency food responses that were out there. We were really hoping to be able to support local farms and local businesses in the food that we were producing, purchasing in for families. Yeah. So we had some of our food from our farm, but we were also sourcing eggs from Connecticut farms, milk from Connecticut farms, produce from farms when we could. It was still early spring, so there wasn't a ton out there. But now we're up to about 70 families that we're delivering to. We didn't want folks to have to leave their homes. A lot of our students have immunocompromised family members or other challenges. They don't have a car. So we have a group of volunteers that's going and delivering door to door. And then we've since expanded quite a bit. We have a mobile market that we usually run during the summer, where we go to different places around New Haven that don't have access to fresh fruit and vegetables at, you know, higher rates or rates that you might find elsewhere in New Haven. But we're not doing a ton of in-person sales right now. So we're actually delivering farm boxes to about 300 families now, starting in July. So it's been kind of a whirlwind, but we definitely couldn't have gotten jump-started without the United Way support. We've long since moved on from that original funding, but it's been a wild ride. It's interesting for a farmer right now.
Now, has enough grown on the farm here at Common Ground come summer that you're now able to really kind of pivot back to being a more primary supplier for these hundreds of families?
I guess the simple answer is no. So what we were, I guess our next step in that program, since we were expanding kind of to our mobile market recipients and We're now delivering to a rotation of senior residences around New Haven, in addition to some community partners in nearby neighborhoods, in addition to our students' families. And we were able to partner with Ciccarelli Farm to provide food boxes for free to these families and seniors and other residences. They receive funding from the USDA in order to provide this free box resource to us. We are growing, obviously, you can see on the farm, we're growing a lot of food, and that food is going to a farm share or a CSA program that's focusing mostly on camp families and other families or folks who are interested in paying for produce. Yep. So it's sort of using that funding to offset the costs, a small fraction of the costs, for the free food box program.
Yeah.
So we have, I guess, about 50 families this week that are coming to pick up produce that we grew on this farm that's being harvested and grown by our youth program. We have about, how many? I guess six. We have six high schoolers and three college-age young people that are working on the farm with us this summer.
Okay.
The other aspect of this that I got it. Keep in focus is that this is a school. It's an educational situation. How have things changed given the early dismissal and non-return into the early summer? You have the entire student body in some way, shape, or form dedicated to the overall effort, and then suddenly your workforce disappeared?
Yeah, so very early on in the spring, we're kind of in a rhythm of having a small cohort of interns, which are usually juniors and seniors that come and help us on the farm, I guess like three times a week, about 8 to 10 of them. And then we do have visits from individual classes if teachers want to use the farm as a site for learning about some sort of project. We're also used to having big groups of volunteers in the spring that help us get all of our beds turned. We don't use any machinery on the farm, so we rely on people power to get the work done.
Yep.
So that was a bit of a challenge because we're used to having big groups come out from, you know, different corporations or Yale or, you know, students around. Starting in July, things changed quite a bit because we started having our college summer intern program and then our Green Job Corps high school program. So we had a bit of a change in terms of who was helping us out on the farm. And it's been really wonderful. I think we didn't realize how much we missed interaction and learning with all the young folks out here. And it's been pretty special to have. Yeah.
So since we're on radio and we can't really see the place unless folks go to your website and or, you know, kind of, you know, Google you and check out pictures, we're in the midst of the garden sitting here at a picnic table. Kids are getting ready to get dismissed from the summer program. So folks may hear some noise in the background as we transition into the second half of the interview. But, you know, there's several outbuildings. There's a number of grow kind of hoop. Type of greenhouses, and then this plot of a garden that we're sitting in the middle of. How much more gardening and farming is occurring beyond the scope of what I can see here?
Yeah, so what you see is about 3/4 of an acre, and we have a little bit more up the hill where we have our animals. So we have chickens, ducks, turkeys, sheep, and that's it. That's our farm. So we're growing pretty intensively on pretty small acreage.
Oh, okay.
But on this particular 3/4 acre, we grow, you know, over probably over 50 different varieties of produce. We have bees. We have the three high tunnels where we do three season growing. And we're growing everything from tomatoes to peppers to cabbage to callaloo. And grow pretty intensively through the end of November. Yeah.
And does virtually everything that you grow go back into either farm share programming or community consumers?
About a third of what we grow goes, or used to grow, into the school cafeteria.
Oh,
so
right.
Usually during the summer, we would actually preserve a lot of items.
Oh, okay.
And then a little bit of what we grow goes to classes. So we have a cooking program that's going on right now that's virtual, and people pick up and then cook together online every Thursday. It's really special, actually. And then the rest of what we grow, goes to farm share. We used to have a farm stand, in-person farm stand, that was pretty robust, but not this year.
Sure.
And then our mobile market was just sort of a different venue. Yeah. So we might have some in-person mobile market stops at the end of the season, like August, September, with Cornell Scott Hill Health Center and the Fairhaven WIC Center. But we're still in conversations about how that might work.
Well, I want to take a quick break. We're sitting here amidst the farm at Common Ground High School, which is the nation's longest running environmental charter school in downtown New Haven, creating the next generation of successful college students and powerful environmental leaders. Deborah Gregg is the farm director. We're going to talk more about how this institution is helping create the future generations of environmental stewards and farmers here in Connecticut. Connecticut beyond. We'll be back. Stay with us.
Do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting an awareness or fundraising activity, or you'd like to find one that's supporting a nonprofit in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit that events tab, and find out how to promote it or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Connecticut's Public Utilities Regulatory Authority wants you to know that although a statewide utility residential shutoff moratorium is scheduled to end on September 9th, customers who are enrolled in a COVID-19 payment program and are current with their payment terms remain exempt from service termination for reasons of non-payment even after the shutoff moratorium is lifted. More importantly, the COVID-19 payment program does not replace existing financial hardship or assistance programs that continue to be available to limited income customers. Those experiencing financial difficulty should contact their utility directly and inquire whether they're eligible for hardship protections and programs. For details, just visit PURA's COVID Actions page for more information on efforts taken in response to the pandemic. Just click on portal.ct.gov/PURA/consumer services.
We're back. Thanks for hanging around here at the farm. We are out in the world and off the phone for a change, and so happy to be meeting Deborah Gregg. She's the farm director at Common Ground High School, a charter school in near downtown New Haven that prepares students for college success and environmental leadership. So Deborah, you're the farm director, but first of all, just give us a little bit of your background. Are you the next in the line of many generations of farmers? Was your dad a dentist and you just liked the farm?
Yeah, I grew up in New York City. I grew up in Brooklyn. So farming was not at all part of how I grew up. But I was always into the environment. I grew up, in the 80s and 90s, so recycling was a really big thing. Yeah. And when I got to college, I wanted to be involved in, movements that supported the environment. And I was also really interested in alternative forms of education. So I'd done theater and art and music and sort of knew that I learned better by experiencing the world. And I got the opportunity the summer before my senior year to develop an education program for high schoolers on a farm that was very close to where I went to college. And just sort of got hooked personally and for the way that it helps you talk to young people sort of about anything. You can talk about nutrition and science and culture and personal stories, and I just sort of love it. So
we can go back to the kind of the old experience of like fire prevention week. It's like teach a kid how to drop and roll and do a home evacuation, and he'll teach his family every chance he gets for the next 10 years. Here you teach a kid how to take something he normally thought was growing on a grocery shelf and teach him how to put the seed in the ground and care for it and turn it into what he would normally go into a big box to buy right out of the ground. But Common Ground goes so much further because that practice and passion and philosophy is by design spreads out to the community at large. Tell us a little bit about your role in helping to lead some of the programming that helps turn these kids into farm and farm-to-table advocates in their own neighborhoods.
Sure. So there's three of us on the farm team. There's myself, there's our farm manager, Diane, and our food justice education coordinator, Disha. And we all do a lot of work to support the teachers at Common Ground to feel comfortable on the farm and feel like they can use it as sort of a learning laboratory. And then we work a lot with students who, I guess we sort of try to meet them where they are, right? Like, not everybody is interested in getting dirty and being on the farm, and there's a lot of history of racism that's tied in with farming in the United States. So we try to understand that and work with young people so that they can sort of meet this experience where they are. So in a typical year, every single ninth grader gets an experience on the farm in their first unit. Every single class they take has a component that causes them to learn more or dig deeper about farming and our agricultural system and food and their own food history and their own bodies. And they tell personal food stories in English class. They come out and do ethnographies of different crops in their social studies class. In math class, they do research on different things that we want to know about on the farm. So they last year they did taste testing and helped us figure out the nutritional quality of products and figure out what type of pepper we should grow based on people's preferences and nutritional value. And this year I think they're going to help us a little bit with our food waste and try to figure out some of the things we can do here and the ways that food waste impacts and signals challenges in a larger food system. As a sophomore, they do more, I guess, outward focus. So they look at New Haven and they look at what people in New Haven are doing. Where are the community gardens? Where are the public health issues? Where are some of the challenges related to food access? And then their junior and senior year, it's more about choice, right? So a student who is like, you know, I'm just not into this, I'm going to step back. That's their thing. They find something else. There's students who are really into cooking and they find a place in our cooking club and testing out recipes that we can use in the cafeteria and connecting it to their own families' food stories and sharing those. Seniors have senior projects that they do in order to graduate. So a lot of students choose to do something physical that's farm related or maybe research based. I was just talking to one of our Green Job Corps students who's working with us this summer. And when she started on the farm, she just sort of volunteered and liked being outside. And we were talking, she was helping process our compost and she was super upset about the amount of food waste and, you know, different things that we see coming into our system. And she was like, you know what, like, I was trying to talk to my family about this and how it's really important for us to try to compost and it's important for us to think about, you know, where our food is coming from and going. And I think I want to do my senior project about how you can talk to your families about those sort of things, because it's a really hard conversation. You know, I think adults, they think they're right, and in some ways they are because they have lived experience, and in some ways young people have so much to say. And I was pretty inspired by her saying that, because it's true. You know, we sort of see this as a place you can come and escape and get connected to bigger issues, but it's also a place where young people can find their own power and voice.
Yeah, it must be kind of challenging when grandparents who came up in the 50s and 60s and the generation of ecology then suddenly saw this flip to this disposable couple of generations where it was just about, we're done with it, toss it out. You know, there wasn't this whole people starving in other parts of the world. You got to eat everything on your plate. There was a lot of this kind of pervasive attitude. But now it seems like I would imagine both the high school students you see as well as the younger ones who come to things like camps and field trips, there's a resurgence in that kind of responsiveness to the greater good in the world, right?
Yeah, and I think I think young people right now, I think there's an opportunity for their voices to really be heard around issues like this. Like, I think there's movements like the Sunrise Movement and different ways that young people are really pushing what people are talking about. In terms of the United States and the way we treat our residents and the way we treat our environment. Because I think it's really easy, once you learn about it or get into something, it's really easy to see the connections and how it can impact you, right? So, like, food waste in New Haven gets shipped to Hartford and Bridgeport to the incinerators. And those are, I just heard a radio piece this morning how those are getting ready to be closed down in the next 7 years, right? Yep. So what happens to that food? What happens to the people who live around that incinerator who've been breathing in that air? A lot of our students have asthma. Mm-hmm. A lot of students who work on the farm have asthma. And you can make those sort of connections, not just, you know, to the bigger environment, but also to you and your families. And also realize that that disproportionately affects communities of color. And and so how can you try to voice and make that change? And I do think people, I think people are listening to younger voices. And I think the younger voices have, they have a lot to say. Our students have a lot to say that we're not thinking about.
And from an educational movement perspective, do you think that the results that you're seeing here as the farm director at Common Ground High School, those are the kind of oasis environments that would do well in any urban community?
I
take for where you grew up?
Yeah, I mean, I think Common Ground is a really special place. Like, I think I just want to acknowledge, like, how unique it is and special, like, even in a city like New Haven that's smaller and has access to the outdoors in a different way. Like, I think the young people who come here have a really different experience than they would if they went to a different high school. It's definitely smaller, but it's also just being able to be on the edge of West Rock and, you know, in this state park and in this beautiful place. And I think that's why we do a lot of our programming with younger kids. So field trips can come from all over New Haven and those kids can have this experience too, at least once or twice a year. But I do feel like young people in general are feeling the impact of their environments on themselves, and it causes responses in different ways. I know that the young people who are, like, sitting on the Board of Education in New Haven right now, I know that food waste is, like, a really huge issue for them. And I'm sure other priorities have shifted since, like, you know, Black Lives Matter movement has sort of risen. But it's interesting to see kids from, young people from all over the city starting to think about these sort of issues, or not just starting to think about them, but feeling like they can voice them and that maybe the adults in the room will hear them.
Yeah. And I have to say, up until this year, I heard the term food insecurity every couple of months. Now I'm hearing it twice a day, maybe more. It's great to know that you're playing a role in helping to educate and perhaps inspire the next generation of folks who are going to go out and do something more about food insecurity. In closing, once we return to whatever the new normal is going to be, or back to normal, if that could ever happen, how do people find out more about how non-students can access either the programs or the bounty of what you have going here at Common Ground High School?
Sure. So folks can visit commongroundct.org and find, like, on our front page, there's tons of info about the different programs we have for younger kids in the community. And then if you just like us on Facebook or Instagram, we're always posting about those cooking classes. We usually run a farm and garden conference three times a year, where everyone can come and learn about technical and food justice issues around growing and eating your own food. So we're shifting to doing that virtually, and we're going to be having a bunch that are coming up once a month for the next few months. So if you go on our Facebook or Instagram, you can find us and learn more about those opportunities to get involved.
Common Ground High School here at the base of West Rock Ridge, 20 acres of forest with hiking trails, wildlife, and diverse natural habitats within the New Haven city limits. Common Ground is seeking and successfully exploring urban ecology and developing paths to urban sustainability. This is the nation's longest running environmental charter school, creating the next generation of successful college students and powerful environmental leaders. Our guest has been their farm director, Deborah Gregg. Deborah, thanks for having us here at Common Ground. And hopefully when things begin to get a little bit more normal, we'll see you a lot more. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for coming by.
Well, it's been a little while since we did a census segment. Our Counting on 2020 series continues now with a brand new friend at the Census Bureau. Jeff Baylor is the regional census director here out of the New York region, which includes Connecticut. We've talked to a number of his counterparts over the course of this series that dates back all the way to last February as things were starting to ramp up for the census. So, Jeff, great to make your acquaintance and to add you to our resource file. Thanks for taking some time this morning. I wanted to start by just asking real quick how Connecticut is doing with the census. We're getting a lot of information from the lieutenant governor that certain areas of the state are doing really, really well. But I guess maybe that's not the case in some areas.
Yeah, and Lieutenant Governor Bicewicz has been fantastic, and thank you so much for having me today. This appreciate the conversation anytime we get to talk about the census because it is so important. So we know as a state, 65.8% self-response. So some people, you know, times people get confused with that. That's not the percentage of people who have been counted. That's the number of households that have self-responded to the 2020 census, meaning they've gone online, they've called one of our toll-free telephone numbers, or they filled it out on paper and mailed it back in. So 65.8%. Nationally, we're at 62.3%. So Connecticut's above the national average. And back in 2010, at the end of the census, the self-response rate for Connecticut was 69.5%. So very close to getting there. I'm confident that the work of the lieutenant governor and all the mayors, the elected officials, the partners throughout the state, the work they're doing and the work that they've done over the past couple years is truly amazing. And it's a testament to their efforts on seeing that Connecticut is leading the region. It's leading our region right now in self-response.
Well, considering our listening area pretty much runs from the New York border all the way up to the Rhode Island border, if you drew a line straight across the middle of the state, we're hitting on communities predominantly south of that, except in western Connecticut, where it could go all the way up to the Massachusetts border. What are a few things that we're seeing in the both the metropolitan and suburban communities in terms of response? Are there any areas that really are going to need an extra push before we talk about push week?
Yeah, so we're looking at areas like Hartford is currently at 43.7% self-response rate, Bridgeport 48.3%, Waterbury 50.4%. So those are some areas. Typically, what we've seen, and this holds true for Connecticut, is the urban areas are typically the more hard to enumerate areas, areas where there's a lot of renters, where there's communities of color, language barriers. Children under the age of five, those are all challenges we have in getting a complete and accurate census. So that's where we're going to be focusing our remaining resources, this remaining time, while our partners continue to do, the focus within their communities as well.
Well, one of our prior census segments really focused heavily on volunteer and employment opportunities tied to the census. And I was surprised when I talked to you for a moment or two before we turned on the microphone this morning that there is still employment opportunities involved. Can we talk about that for just a second?
Yeah, absolutely. We are hiring enumerators. So it's we started today and we have three offices across the state of Connecticut. Our Hartford area census office, which covers Tallinn, Windham, Hartford, New London counties, they started knocking on doors today. And what we're going to do because of COVID-19 and many people who've applied for these jobs 6-8 months ago are no longer interested, we're going to continually hire and train people until we have every device in the hands of, you know, a Connecticut resident that wants to be out in their community working for the census. We're paying anywhere from $23.50 to $25 per hour, depending on where you live. So great opportunities. You can go to 2020census.gov/jobs. It takes about 15 to 20 minutes to apply online. Get your application in. We're making calls every day trying to increase the amount of staff we have working throughout Connecticut.
Great. And Jeff is talking about today where we tape the program, which is on Thursday before the Sunday broadcast. So actually, by the time you hear this interview, census workers will already have been on the street for a couple of days. So that's great. And great to hear that there's employment opportunities still available as well. But most importantly is the participation ratios, especially in some of the urban areas that are served by our radio stations. Jeff Baylor's with us. He's the regional census director for the New York region that includes Connecticut for the 2020 census here on the next in our ongoing series called Counting on 2020. And there is a big, big event coming up starting this week. Jeff, let's talk about Push Week.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, April 1st is typically the main week during every decade we get during a census where there's a lot of buzz about the census. April 1st, it's the reference day. It's the day we're snapping the picture on the camera to take a look at what our communities look like across our nation. So regardless of when you're filling out the census, we're asking you who lived there as of April 1st. So we have media, we have events and things like that. And we didn't have that this decade. And rightly so. COVID-19, people were worried about, you know, their jobs or where they're going to find their next meal. They're worried about their children, their health. So we're trying to recreate that week. And we're going to do it in our region, July 27th through August 2nd. We're going to be purchasing additional media buys in every media market throughout our region, including all of Connecticut. And then our partners are doing some really cool things to promote the census, whether that's just blasting out emails, posting on social media, hosting an event where you allow your community members to come in. Maybe it's a food distribution site. And, you know, as they're picking up their food, stop by our table and fill out your census right then and there. Someone can help you out. We have staff who speak multiple languages. Anything we can do to provide resources to ensure every community in Connecticut gets a complete and accurate count.
So in terms of this event, I mean, are there communities that are kind of really embracing this to the extent that they can and is safe in doing these really high profile kind of almost festival like activities?
Yeah, most of the events that we'll be supporting next week are take into account the social distancing, a lot of like things like food sites, COVID testing sites. Again, where we have the ability, our staff wear masks. You know, they practice social distancing where we, you know, these are typically outdoor type events. I just was at three events this week with the Hartford School District in which at food distribution sites, we set up tables where we helped people fill out their 2020 census, educated on them, maybe gave them the information they need. So when they go home, they can take out their smartphone and they can go online to 2020census.gov and fill it out. So those are the type of events. We have to be safe. We want to keep our employees' health in mind. We want to keep our employees safe. We absolutely want to keep the safety of our public top priority. So these are more kind of outdoor type events that we're supporting throughout Connecticut.
Yeah, and I know we mentioned Lieutenant Governor Bisewitz earlier because it is really her charge as Lieutenant Governor in Connecticut this time around to be the point person. And it's not like the governor hasn't been busy doing other things, as well as the Lieutenant Governor and all Connecticut officials. But she has also done a good job, if not helping align municipal leaders behind the push going all the way back before April 1st, even. She was doing in-person appearances all across Connecticut in towns large and small. But really, most of, if not all of the lead officials in all of the 169 Connecticut municipalities and communities have stepped up as well and are real cheerleaders for the census. So they really deserve kind of a radio round of applause here as well, right?
Absolutely. They really do. I mean, they've created that foundation of trust for their community members. And it starts with the lieutenant governor. Day one, the census was on her radar. I met with her shortly after she took office, and we've been working together ever since. She's been fantastic, tireless in her efforts in getting out there. And what that does, that creates that base of trust that allows local leaders to then jump on board, and then community members and church leaders and business owners to all jump on board. The more people that are out there talking about the census, letting people know it's safe, talking about how easy it is to complete it and what's at stake for the next 10 years, the more people that give that message out, the more people that hear that message, the more people will eventually go online and fill out the census. And that's exactly why Connecticut is doing so well, because of the leaders throughout the state that have just been amazing over the past couple of years.
Well, it starts tomorrow, folks, and runs through August 2nd, Push Week, to determine who can push a greater self-response rate for the 2020 census. Our guest has been Jeff Baylor here on the next in our ongoing series called Counting on 2020 Census Segments. And he is the regional census director for New York, incorporating Connecticut. Jeff, thanks for your time again, and best of luck as you move through Push Week and beyond with the 2020 census stats. Thanks. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.